Accession number 21729, wheel 6.
Frank Cotton, wheel 6.
Okay. We had one American sergeant with us, Charlie Young. And Charlie was of Chinese extract. And he looked every inch a Chinaman. About 5 foot tall, a straight black pin wire hair, yellow complexion, high cheekbones, slant eyes. Because we had no razors at the time, a wispy Fu Manchu type beard. And the Chinese worked on him to get him to defect back to the motherland, as they called it. But Charlie knew which side his bread was buttered. He was a GI, and come the day, he was going back to the States. In the end, they gave up on him and quit pestering him. And one day, a group of us were being harangued for, including Charlie, for something we'd done or hadn't done. Charlie got fed up and blew his top, and he said to the interpreter, "Oh, you make me sick. You guys, when I listen to you, you guys make me ashamed to be Chinese." So now the interpreter blew his top. "You are not Chinese. We do not recognize you as Chinese." Well, no. 5 foot tall, slant eyes, yellow complexion, all the features of a Chinaman, being told, "We do not recognize you as Chinese."
Did he speak Chinese?
No, not as far as I know. Okay, said Charlie. "So I'm a goddamned Irishman. From now on, call me O'Toole." And the interpreter didn't seem to have any answer to that. There was one time when the Chinese came along and said, told us we were going to have to build beds. At the time, we were sleeping on the floor. The Brits, we had no particular objection to this. We didn't see any great merit in sleeping on the floor. They weren't beds as we know them. I think the Chinese call them kangs. They're more like shelves that run down the side of the wall of the building of the hut. Anyway, the Americans took it into their heads that the Chinese had an ulterior motive for this. And they worked it out that the Red Cross are coming and they want things to appear better than they really are. And so we're not going to cooperate. And so for the next few days, there were conversations around the camp between Americans and Chinese interpreters that went something like this. "Today, you build a bed." "I know, build a bed." "Today, you build a bed." "I know, build a bed." "You build a bed." "I know, build a bed." "You go to jail." "I build a bed." So that was one American revolution that didn't last very long. And we had quite a few black Americans as POWs too. One in particular, some of them were great guys, infinitely preferable to some of the scroungy white ones that were among them, I can tell you. One of them in particular, little fella, little stocky chap, named Banks, who we called Monty Banks. And there was one thing Monty hated was snakes. He had a great fear of anything that wriggled and had no legs, from a caterpillar upwards. And there was quite a lot of snakes in Korea, from things about 3 or 4 foot long to little pencil-sized snakes. Some of them poisonous, some of them not, and we didn't know which were which. We were out in the hills one day collecting wood, which the Chinese required us to do from time to time. And we would go out there to wherever the place was, and they would post guards around the hill, and we would then be let loose on the hill. We weren't supposed to, what the Chinese called, destroy the Korean people's trees, so it was supposed to be dead stuff that we were captured, we were collecting and bringing back. Anyway, one hot summer afternoon, we were out there, and there was such a commotion. Chinese guards yelling, and little Monty dashing down the hill. He was just wearing a pair of white shorts and dashing down the hill as fast as his little legs could carry him. And Chinese were getting agitated. It looked as though he was trying to escape, and rifle bolts were getting rattled. And somebody dived for him and brought him down. What you doing, man? What's the matter? And Monty lay there, very, very black face, with his white eyes rolling around in it, and said, "Man, there's a snake on that there hill. And I says to him, I says, Mr. Snake, there ain't room for you and me on this here hill, so I's leaving. He risked being shot rather than a confrontation with a snake. There is something I might have mentioned earlier when we first got to Camp One, and I said that how awful the state of the POWs in there was at the time, and how they were dying off. Things did improve. We never got like the Americans were at that time, probably because things improved. The food improved. Eventually, medical backup improved, even to the extent where one or two people had operations done that our own medics, when we got back, said they'd been done extremely well. But initially, it was very, very rough, and there were just a couple of Chinese medical orderlies who were nicknamed Blood and Puss, because they were the only two words of English that they seemed to know, and they assumed anybody who was sick was suffering from dysentery, hence the question, blood. And that was at the time when people were going into the hospital, which, if I remember right, there was an old Korean temple, and really nobody much expected them to come out once they went in there. And we suffered from all kinds of mainly vitamin deficiency diseases, beriberi, pellagra, night blindness, wart-like things that came in your mouth, dysentery and diarrhea, and it was a fairly rough time for a few months. But as I say, things gradually improved, the food improved, medical supplies improved, they stopped lecturing us, we got some sports gear, and it became eventually more like a POW camp, the way we think of it, you know, from World War II.
Were you interrogated at any stage?
Oh, yeah, frequently, but not for...
Individually?
Yeah, but not so much for military reasons. I think there was some military interrogation went on, and quite possibly some of the senior officers who were captured would have been interrogated for military purposes. Most of the interrogations that took place in the camps were to see how much of the indoctrination you'd actually absorbed. And they were a bit hilarious at times, because the interpreters didn't really know what they were about, and they didn't really understand the Western society or Western culture any more than we understood theirs. And so occasionally some smart interpreter wanting to impress you with how much he really did know, in the middle of other questions, would throw in some silly one like, now tell me, why is Guinness good for you? He'd seen the advert somewhere, you know. And they would try to demoralise you with silly statements like, what will your family do now the rainy season has arrived and you're not home to help plant the rice? I remember one London laddie coming out of an interrogation like that one day looking totally bemused and shaking his head and saying, they don't seem to understand. We don't grow a lot of rice around Tooting Broadway. So there was interrogation, but as I say, it was for political indoctrination purposes rather than for military reasons.
Were you treated differently in Camp 4?
Not really, no. We were treated much as we had been before we left Camp 1, when the lectures had ceased. And there were just the peace talk briefings that that I mentioned, and that carried on the same in Camp 4. We did much the same as we did in Camp 4. When we had sports gear, we played sports. We went out into the hills collecting wood, which we used to use for cooking our own food and for heating our own accommodation. No doubt the Chinese had their share of it as well, you know, for their purposes, but that was only to be expected. And generally it was a continuation of what life had been like in Camp 1 in the last few months that we were there, that just carried on into Camp 4 with a lot of different people with us.
Did anyone try to escape?
Oh, frequently. In fact, the fellow I mentioned earlier, Captain Farah Hockley, he spent more time on the run, I think, than he did in POW camps. But lots of people tried to escape. It was no problem getting out of a camp. There were no barbed wire around the camp. I mean, the Chinese had an abundance of men. They didn't have so much barbed wire. So the camp would be a village, and there'd be sentries on the roads that went through and in the areas all around it. And it wasn't difficult to get out. But the problem was, once you got out, nobody ever made a home run. We were different to the... You couldn't merge with the population the way you could in, say, Germany or France. We had big noses and different coloured hair and round eyes, not slant eyes, and different coloured complexions and so on. And so once anyone got out of the camp, once they were spotted, all the villagers in the area would turn out with blunderbusses and sickles and scythes and billhooks and rakes and hunt the guy down. And so nobody was ever on the run for more than a few days at a time, and nobody actually made a total break and got back, to the western side of the lines, as it were. I remember one technically, four of us escaped one day. We were... The Chinese introduced this business of what they call calisthenics early in the morning, PT, And I think this was after they began to realise that one day they were going to have to account for all these prisoners they claimed to have captured, and so they'd better start treating them better and keeping them a little bit fitter than they had been in the earlier days. And so they introduced this calisthenics every morning. And one morning they were in the house, Korean house that I was in, room not as big as this, I suppose, and there were about four or five of us sleeping in there on the floor at the time. And they came to get us out about some ridiculous time in the morning for calisthenics. And we rebelled and we said we're not going. And we pretended to be asleep and, went all through the motions of being difficult. Eventually the interpreter fetched a guard with a rifle and bayonet who made sure we got out. So he said, you must do calisthenics. And we said, well, they're finished now, it's too late. It's all over. And so this guy said, all right, then you must do a run. So we said, okay. And we set off. There was me, a fellow called McAnulty from the Northumberland Fusiliers, an Hawaiian American called DeFontes, and a Texan, Larry Morris. And we were in charge, we were under the charge of one of the ugliest Chinamen I've ever seen in my life. We used to call him Louis the Gook, and he didn't speak any English. And we set off on the road after the camp, and it was a misty morning. And by that time, I think we were fitter than Louis was, because we left him behind. And when we were out of sight in the mist, we left the road and went down the side. It was a road with paddy fields each side below this built-up road. And we nipped down the bank into the paddy field and just lay there and waited for Louis to go lumbering by, calling out to us in Chinese to stop or whatever. And when he'd gone and out of sight, we got up and ran back along the road into the camp like four good POWs. And went to our huts. So technically we'd escaped. And about half an hour later there was such a commotion. Louis had come back to the camp and I suppose reported four prisoners on the loose. And so they wanted everybody out for a head count. And when they came into our hut, the four prisoners on the loose all sat there looking innocent, saying, what's the matter? Is there a problem? Or words to that effect. They realised we'd taken the mickey out of them, and of course the Chinese never liked to lose face, and so they said, you must do calisthenics now. And so DeFontes, this American Hawaii, got out in front and as the sort of instructor and said, right, with me, finger waggling begin. And we stood there like this. Thumb rolling, you know. When it got to eyebrow twitching, the Chinese realised again we were taking the mickey. So they said, right, you must do another run. Well, it was still misty, so we said, oh, great, yeah, fun, yeah, we'll do that. He said, you must run from that sentry to that sentry three times. And so we did that, did a little war dance around the sentry at each end, which upset them. And they dismissed us back to the hut. Honour was satisfied all round, I suppose. And that was the end of that little episode. But, as I say, it wasn't difficult to escape from the camps. It was very difficult to get very far once you got out, though, and nobody ever did
get very far. What were the facilities like, for instance, latrines? And
well, initially, they were awful. We dug pits very close to the huts, which stank to high heaven in the summer. And froze solid in the winter. You can imagine with everybody with stomach complaints, and a lot of them with dysentery and so on, it's a pretty horrible thing. Pits with boards across. And then when, as the winter drew to an end, the Chinese would make us go and dig this stuff out as it began to thaw a little, soften up. And we had to carry it in a sort of metal tray, like a stretcher, only it was a metal thing with arms on, over the river that flowed by the side of the camp, and dump it in the paddy fields the other side. It's the Chinese used human excrement for fertilizer in the, with their rice and so on. Occasionally, of course, there was a mishap, because these rivers, especially after there'd been rain, could be fairly swift flowing, and the bottoms were usually loose boulders and so on. And so you'd have a couple of guys carrying a tray, and they'd lose their footing and find themselves sitting on the river bed holding this tray of manure above their head, and the choice was to sit there and drown or let go of it and get covered in the damn stuff. Well, nobody drowned, but nobody came out smelling of roses either. Eventually, we had something vaguely resembling a latrine. Usually built over a ditch, storm ditches. When it rained, it all got washed down into the river, and with shelters above the top. So it, from the outside, it looked like a hut or a shed. Inside was pretty gruesome, but as I say, it went into the ditch and eventually got washed away, so we didn't have to dig it out anymore. And that was where most of the rumours emanated from. The Americans were real rumour mongers. They would believe anything. Even the guy who started the rumour would believe it when it eventually got back to him. And they used to say, it was an expression, oh, this one's straight, this is not a rumour, straight from Trap 3, meaning the Trap 3 in the latrine. Some of them were quite ludicrous. I mean, people would come out and say, have you heard the latest? Dick Barton's back pounding a beat, or Captain Marvel's made major, Mickey Mouse turned out to be a rat, or silly things like that. There was one occasion when some American guy, I can't remember his name, he knew the war was over. This is not a rumour, this is straight gen. How do you know? I heard a Chinese guard and a Korean talking about it. But you don't speak Chinese or Korean. No, he said. But they didn't speak each other's language either, and they were talking in Japanese. But you can't speak Japanese. No, but I've got a mate in my hut who spent a long time in Japan, and he can speak Japanese quite a bit. And I memorized some of what was said, repeated it to him, and he said, oh, yeah. And they believed it. They actually believed this nonsense, that the war was over, because of some guy who claimed to have memorized something in Japanese said by a Korean or a Chinaman. But I suppose they lived in hope. When other things were scarce, there was always plenty of rumors to keep them going.
Did you have any experience of what the medical people term psychogenic urinary problems, which they were saying the cause of being Fear of the Night?
No. And I don't know anyone else who did either. Unless it was arose by some other name. I know there were people who suffered with night blindness, but that was a vitamin deficiency thing. And once it got dark, they could, you know, if they wanted to go to the latrines in the night, someone had to go with them because they couldn't see. But I've never come across that expression, or neither do I know anyone who suffered with anything that might fall into that sort of category of being afraid of the night. No.
Did you experience anyone being very harshly treated, tortured?
There were people who were roughly treated. The main Chinese system of retribution was to throw people into jail, which was usually a room in a Korean house or hut, and demand that they confess their mistakes or realise their mistakes and confess their errors or misdemeanours without actually telling them what they were supposed to have done. Sometimes it was obvious. I mean, if a man had escaped and been caught for a couple of days, you know, or if he'd given a lot of lip to a Chinese interpreter or something like that. But their main system of retribution was to make people write a confession, what they called self-criticism, and then read it out to the multitude, to all his compatriots. Possibly, I don't know whether the Chinese thought that made them lose face and that was a punishment, or whether it was a genuine sort of communist thing of realising your errors and seeking to correct them. But most of these, I mean, we all knew that the guy didn't mean what he said, whatever he said, and very often they couched it in such words that we could barely suppress from laughing because we knew it was nonsense. And the Chinese command of the English language wasn't sufficient for them to pick up the undertones and overtones, you know, and realise what was really being said. I know one time we were locking about one evening and we pulled a sentry box down on top of one of our lads, and the Chinese sentry got all upset and it wasn't his job. They had an odd division of labour. The sentry's job was to make sure he didn't go outside of a certain perimeter. What happened inside that was the problem of the camp admin staff, the interpreters and people like that. So he got upset about his sentry box being pulled over, and he went up to the office, as it were, and brought an interpreter down, who sat on the box so that the lad couldn't get out, and interrogated him through, you know, in a sentry box. There's a little hole in each side that the sentry can look out of as well as looking out the front. Interrogated him through the hole. So, who's that in there? It's whatever his name was. Say Johnson. What are you doing in the people's sentry box, Johnson? I was walking past and it fell on me. Well, they didn't believe that, of course. So eventually they took him off up to the office, and I think it was one of those occasions where we went outside and made a fuss because we knew it wasn't Mac's fault, Johnson's fault. It was, you know, the rest of us who pinned him down in there. And I think on that occasion, other than probably apologising verbally and saying I won't do it again, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, and all the rest of it, I don't think he actually had to write a self-criticism. But that was their usual. But there were occasions when people were roughly treated. They built some, you can only call them cages, inside one of the Korean houses, where there wasn't room to stretch properly or do anything, and one or two people were sort of incarcerated in those for periods. And also they used to stick people in a hole in the ground which was covered up, and in summer that could get quite hot. In winter it was bloody cold. In fact, we had a warning system. If anybody was doing something they shouldn't be, and a Chinaman hove over the horizon, we used to shout, "Mind the hole!" Didn't mean anything to the Chinaman, but to our guys it meant the fear of getting dumped in the hole, you know, in the prison, as it were, the hole in the ground. So yes, there were some, but in the camps I was in, there were, I can't say there was a lot of that sort of, there were some, certainly there were some. I think the people who suffered the worst treatment and even torture were more in the early days when the Koreans had the charge of the POWs, and people who went to interrogation centres at the one near Pyongyang, which was nicknamed Pak's Palace. I think Pak was the name of the guy who, the Korean officer who ran it. Because the Koreans were a fairly brutal lot. I had a guy with me, he was in POW with me, he was in my platoon before he was captured, who had already done 4 years as a POW of the Japs. He was one of these reservists called back. You know, no wonder they were upset. And he used to say that the worst treatment that he ever saw when he was a prisoner of war of the Japanese was done by the guards, or in fact were Koreans, didn't matter north or south. Korea was part of the Japanese Empire up until the end of the Second World War.
So they emulated their forms of torture.
Probably.
You mentioned that the food improved after a while. What did you have when it improved?
Oh, all kinds of things. A little meat, not a vast amount, but some. You know, you might get a small pig between about 300 men that the cooks had to turn into some sort of stew or soup. We got rice more and more. And whatever vegetables were sort of in season, cucumbers, for instance, they grew cucumbers out there. But sometimes we would get quite a lot of cucumbers. I think tomatoes too. I'm absolutely sure about that. I'm sure at some stage we had tomatoes as well, and eggs. So that as time went on, while the food was never what you get at the Dorchester, it was you know, reasonable. And even at its worst, I mean, to be honest about it, we didn't get anything different to what the Chinese themselves were eating at the time. So you know, you can't really complain about that. We got steamers. They brought in steamers so that we could make bread. First, they tried making it out of millet flour. It wasn't awfully successful. And then, eventually, we got, I suppose it was wheat or corn flour. Because they used to grow what we call sweet corn, you know, maize out there. And we used to make bread, steamed bread. And I remember at one time, they actually brought in some loaves of bread in sacks. They were very old, and they were dumped in a store in the winter, so they were very, very solid, because it's damn cold in Korea. Up there in those North Korean hills, 30 below was not at all unusual in the depth of winter, January time. And then they gave us one loaf between three, and there was nothing we could do with it. You'd have broken your teeth even trying. We had to get the saws, the cross-cut saws that we use for wood cutting, and cut the loaf into three with a cross cut, and then leave it around long enough out of the chill for it to soften up a little bit so you can actually eat it. But it did, as I say, it did improve, and the food was you know, not too bad towards the end of the period, or perhaps halfway through onwards.
Did you receive mail while you were there?
Well, there was another story. Sometime after the sergeants were separated, so it was sometime during 1951, they came along one day with pieces of paper and said, "You can write home to your people. You must tell them." And we said, "No way." You know, it was given a whole new meaning to the phrase Red Letter Day if you wrote the stuff that they wanted you to write and sent it home. And so all the British sergeants, we refused to write. with these conditions. We knew they wouldn't get anywhere if we didn't put this rubbish in anyway. And so there's no point in it. Because we weren't going to put that in. About twice that happened, they came along with these papers and said, you can write home to your loved ones, but you must tell them this, this, this and this. And we said, no, sod off, or words to that effect. Then one day, early in 52, they came along and said, you can write home to your people. End of story. Now, we didn't know it at the time, but sometime around about the turn of the year, at the peace talks at Panmunjom, they had exchanged lists of POWs, so that back home...